Hello, it's Friday, October the 15th. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up... At last, the government is scrapping costly PCR travel tests when people return from trips abroad. More and more pregnant women hospitalised with COVID because they've fallen for anti-vax propaganda. Hybrid working, is it the way of the future? Some suggestions, 9 in 10 of us don't want to go back to pre-COVID working patterns. The Queen, she appears to have criticised world leaders for inaction on climate crisis. I bet Prince Charles is pleased. But first, the National Trust, a revolt by members against the woke tendency in the management of the charity. The National Trust is accusing members within their own organisation of waging an anti-woke ideological campaign. They're talking about Restore Trust, which is a splinter group which has amassed more than 6,000 current and former Trust members in support of their campaign, criticising, for instance, the report which blacklisted, if I'm allowed to use that word, 93 estates over links to slavery. Joining me now is Neil Bennett, who's a director of that organisation, Restore Trust. Neil, I know anecdotally friends, contacts who've left the National Trust in droves because they think they've simply lost the plot. They want them to be the custodian of the countryside, custodian of historic houses, and instead they're getting finger-wagging lectures over colonialism.
Well, exactly, Andrew, and thank you for having me on. What I'd love to say first is that I and my friends and colleagues in Restore Trust love the National Trust. We think it is an incredibly important organisation that, and the word trust is terribly important, that holds in trust the nation's heritage. It's a vital part of the national fabric. And that's why we were increasingly distressed by the direction it was heading. And I think, and there's so many examples of that. You mentioned the slavery report. That's really only one. And we saw increasing issues, you know, with closing some of their historic homes, denouncing some of their historic homes, doing ridiculous things like removing historic furniture and replacing it with bean bags, which is just frankly insulting to the intelligence of both visitors and the people that donated those homes. And even, you know, getting children to come in school parties and denounce the former owners of their homes, which felt to me to have sort of distinct Maoist tendencies. And there's almost a cultural revolution going on within the National Trust. And I find it, you know, both absurd and completely misplaced that they're accusing us of being ideologues when actually we came together to prevent the dangerous ideology which we see has taken hold in the National Trust.
Now, and your Restore Trust is putting up candidates, as I understand it, Neil, for the...
Not quite, and not yet.
Right.
And this is really, you know, we recognise this is the start of a long campaign. We didn't have the opportunity by the time we came together to put our own candidates up for council. So what we've done is we've recommended a slate of 6 people who we feel best embody our values and urged, you know, our supporters to vote for that slate. We've also, and it's important, we've put forward a series of motions to the annual meeting. There were originally 4 motions, one of which was no confidence in the chairman. But the chairman then resigned 24 hours after we submitted that motion. So we're not pressing ahead with that one. He's gone. So there's quite a lot going to go on the 30th of October at the AGM.
Will you be there?
I will be there. In fact, Restore Trust is going to be having a reception the night before. And all your listeners are welcome to attend, where you can meet the people behind it.
Well, I think we'll certainly be there. And where are you doing that?
We are just choosing the venue at the moment, but we will publicise it on the website. And I would urge your listeners to go to our website and get a better sense of who we are and what we're about.
And what is it? www.restoretrust?
Restore-trust.org.uk.
Okay. And just finally, Neil, is this a battle, in a sense, for the heart and soul of the National Trust? Because many people think it's lost its way. I can remember the row a few years ago when they insisted that volunteers wore badges supporting the LGBT community. I say as a gay man, I thought it was outrageous, and I would have refused to wear one myself. But they backed down on that. But that was just another example, in my view, of where it's going wrong.
I think it is absolutely a battle on several fronts. Certainly, I don't know, certainly for the soul of the National Trust. You know, the National Trust should be first and foremost interested in preserving the nation's heritage, not pursuing political campaigns. It's also for me, and the different members of Restore Trust have different focuses. One of mine is ensuring that the National Trust is more democratic, so it listens to its members and its members have a say. I got pulled into this when I read the National Trust Constitution, and it was clear they had watered down the say of members to an extraordinary degree. And actually, I had a meeting with National Trust recently where I was lectured by one of their senior members of staff on how dangerous it was to allow members to have a say. The National Trust has been, since its foundation, a members' organization. It's not a quango. And there's 5 million members who deserve to be heard. I just happen to be one of them.
Well, I'm glad, and you're being heard on this podcast, Neil, and we'll be talking to you again, and the best of luck with the campaign. That's Neil Bennett, who is a director of Restore Trust. Do look at their website. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. Has the Queen criticised world leaders over inaction on the climate crisis? She said, we heard her saying it, she's irritated by individuals who talk but don't do. The remarks were picked up on a live stream at the opening of the Welsh Parliament in Cardiff on Thursday, and our very own Royal Editor Rebecca English was there and heard it, and she joins me now. Could there be any doubt what she was talking about, Rebecca?
Oh, no doubt whatsoever. She was obviously there at an official engagement. She was opening the Welsh Parliament. She was speaking to the Leader of Parliament, you know, officially saying goodbye in front of the media. So there was no doubt about what was heard. And you know, I should stress, it's not controversial. It's not stepping into political territory, but it's just very fascinating to hear what she thinks on any one subject, because we so rarely hear it.
So rarely hear it. That we had that overheard expression about, I hope people vote very carefully, I think it was something like that,
we
just
did.
Before the Scottish referendum.
We did, yeah.
And we wondered if she'd wanted people to hear that she was saying that. Do you think, Rebecca, bearing in mind how shrewd and canny she is, A, will she be irritated that this has been picked up and reported, or B, was it possible that she wanted it to be picked up?
It's a very good question. Obviously, Scotland's not the first time that's happened. A few years ago, I don't know if you remember, but she made some comments when she went to a private visit at the Women's Institute at Sandringham,
Do
you remember the kind of very toxic political discourse that was going on around Brexit, and talking about how the Women's Institute was a great example of kind of seeking a more genteel kind of middle way, and there was no doubt that they wanted that to be heard. I don't think that was the case in yesterday, but nevertheless it was, you know, uttered in front of the media, and I don't think actually it's something she should be embarrassed about, because we've heard obviously her son, an heir, the Prince of Wales, and also the Duke of Cambridge, pontificating very loudly with the BBC on this very subject just this week. So, you know, she's kind of following in their footsteps.
And of course, Rebecca, she will be at the COP26 environmental conference in Glasgow at the end of the month, as will Prince Charles, as will Camilla and the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. So this won't do her any harm at all when she steps into that arena.
Not at all. And actually, it's funny, because one of the comments she made was about she had no idea who was attending, and, you know, she'd only heard who was not coming. And within hours of the Daily Mail and others running this story, Scott Morrison, one of those people, the Prime Minister of Australia, suddenly announced he was coming. So maybe she has done quite a little bit of good in giving her Prime Ministers a bit of a, you know, poke with the stick and getting them to come over and take part in COP26.
And Rebecca, just finally, she will make a speech, I suppose, at COP26?
We haven't been told yet. We haven't been told what the details of the engagements are, but I can imagine she will be welcoming those that have come to her. And I think the fact that they've got the five most senior members of the royal family all out there shows you the importance with which the royal family and obviously the British government are taking this.
And just finally on that, of course, they all were at G7. And I was told by someone who was there that Angela Merkel, who was then the German Chancellor, was just beside herself with excitement. It's still that impact she has, even on powerful world leaders like Angela Merkel, Donald Trump, Joe Biden.
I see it every day. And in fact, you mentioned Donald Trump. And much was kind of said and written about his state visit when he came to the UK and he was shown around Buckingham Palace, and I was there for that. And honestly, it was watching like watching a kind of overexcited schoolboy. He didn't know where to put his hands. He was on his best behaviour. He was kind of shooting the media little kind of rueful glances, as if to go, "Oh God, I can't quite believe I'm here." And actually, all the staff said to me afterwards, he was a delight to have there. He was the perfect house guest. So it does just show. This is a woman who's not just lived history, she is history. And, you know, we're very lucky, I think, and I hope your listeners do, to have her in public life.
Couldn't agree more, Rebecca. That's the Daily Mail's Royal Editor, Rebecca English. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our podcast and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Is hybrid working now the future? A report by the Work Foundation and the Chartered Management Institute for the Prospect Union has made a series of recommendations to the government to help businesses and workers get the most out of hybrid working. Almost 9 in 10 workers have said they don't want to go back to pre-COVID working patterns, and on average they want to work remotely if they can for up to 3 days a week. I'm joined now by Mike Clancy, who is General Secretary of that union, Prospect. Mr Clancy, it's a high number, isn't it? 9 in 10, and they want to do it no more than a 2 day week in the office or the factory or the workplace.
Yes, I mean, I think this reflects a pandemic experience, but we also put this in the context that flexible working is a bigger topic than just working from home, not least because some occupations, some jobs won't have the access to working from home given the nature of the work. So this is a much broader topic in terms of hybrid working than just the question of working from home. It's a broader issue about flexibility.
Yeah, I mean, also there will be issues for employers, won't there? Because, for instance, if you think about some civil servants who get paid the London waiting allowance, they're currently Whitehall is pretty deserted, as I'm sure you know. There will be some pressure, I'm quite sure, at some point when people will say, why are we paying civil servants all this London waiting allowance? That's meant to insulate them against the cost of public transport, which, as we know, is astronomically expensive in Britain. If they're not, in fact, using that public transport, is there going to be pressure on people's wages?
Well, the question of civil service pay is much broader than just the question of London allowance, where it is paid. And the extent to which employers will want to have a conversation about the impact on the home as opposed to the less requirement to travel will be something that I'm sure will come up in negotiations with the unions in due course. But, the focus on just simply that economic question of allowances is missing, again, the bigger point. What are people doing? How well are they doing it? What's their efficiency levels? And that'll be the broader conversation we'll want to engage in.
Sure. I'm sorry to just sound negative all the time, because I'm not, because I do work from home from time to time. But we know that one of the issues that have surfaced out of the pandemic is an astonishing rise in the number of people reporting problems with mental illness. And a lot of that is attributed to being locked down, not getting out, not visiting people, not having the daily routine, perhaps, of interaction in a workplace. And so those people presumably might want to work full time in the office, but perhaps employers are going to decide, well, no, actually, we don't need you in 5 days a week. So in a funny sense, it could affect them perversely too.
Look, that is absolutely right. There is a much broader context to this. First of all, I don't think that we are yet clear about the mental health impact and its duration and its content arising out of the pandemic. And that will manifest itself at work and in other parts of civic society. I would agree with you that for some people, for many people, exclusive working from home ultimately felt like isolation and dislocation. And that, I think, is what drives people's desires for more hybrid working, 2 or 3 days maybe in an office environment. And also remembering that many people have occupations where they move around anyway, where they may be have pre-pandemic only attended an office to a certain number of days and otherwise were out with clients or whatever. We are saying that there needs to be a much broader conversation about this, and that hybrid working and the impact upon people's mental health and their home circumstances, there is intergenerational issues here. If you are at the younger end of your career, depending on your domestic circumstances, home working may be far less of a comfortable proposition, particularly if you're in shared occupancy. If you're at the more established end of your career, clearly, if your domestic circumstances allow, you may be able to work from home with more comfort. That's why we're encouraging employers, unions, to sit down and have this conversation. And whilst we talk about issues like the right to disconnect, and in particular, maybe some legislative support to that, the best conversations are going to happen when they relate directly to the employer's environment and employees get a say in it. And I think those issues around mental health will come out very, very strongly in terms of what people are looking for. I also acknowledge employers will have to balance this against economic imperatives such as the shape and availability of their estate. What I would encourage employers to do at the minute is not to do anything too precipitative too quickly, but to stand back and just look at these trends with a slightly longer lens.
Yeah. And is there a specific recommendation you would like employers, perhaps, I'm not thinking of the government, public sector, in the private sector, if they've got a large workforce who've been working from home, what would be the most important thing you would encourage them to do if they are to try to accommodate a changing style of work?
I think that, first of all, they should make every effort to communicate collectively and individually with the workforce and assemble a body of evidence about what is really people's feelings about this subject. If you look at what we went through in that 18 months, in the March and April when we first locked down, it was novel. There was a global emergency. The weather was good. And we were all reacting to unprecedented conditions. And some views of home working and flexibility would have been fashioned in that space, which might well have changed or moderated by the time we were experiencing it for the third, maybe even the fourth time, in January, February of this year, when the experience of winter and lockdown, I think, impacted many people's attitude, particularly about the desirability of exclusive home working, and where that also was accompanied by the difficulty of homeschooling, where people had children off school. So I think there's been a full range of experiences now, and employers shouldn't be buffeted by the binary choices of at home or in the office, and should try and define the trends within their own workforces, their own working environment, and make sure they've gone through a strong process of consultation before they start down the line of changing their employment procedures, making decisions about their estate. And I think that will be the thing that will bring about the best consensus. Clearly, no employer, no employee group is going to get everything tailored to their absolute personal desires. But the extent to which the workforce sees that they've been engaged, I think, will be crucial to people buying into a new set of working practices.
Interesting. That's Mike Clancy. He's General Secretary of Prospect Trade Union. Pregnant women who've not been vaccinated now make up nearly a fifth of the most ill COVID patients in intensive care. Misinformation by so-called anti-vaxxers, who are wicked in my book, has been blamed by officials for fueling false beliefs that the jabs pose risks to expectant mothers. I'm joined now by Sarah McMullen, who's Director of Impact and Engagement at childbirth charity NCT. Sarah, every medic professor I've spoken to says it is so important that women have the jab, and pregnant women should have the jab too.
Yes, this is what we're hearing from the Royal Colleges of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists and midwives and the health service, which is that there's really good evidence now, both of the risks of COVID during pregnancy and also about safety and how well the vaccine works during pregnancy. It is, of course, pregnant women's choice. We're here to try and support an informed choice. And we've been really concerned to hear of so much misinformation and confusion around the vaccine, which we believe has led to real hesitancy to have it.
And this data shows pregnant women account for 32% of all females between 16 and 49 in intensive care. Is your view, Sarah, that the reason we can't say the reason they're intensive care is because they didn't have the vaccine, but is your view that they have been scared about having an injection because they think it will impact on perhaps in the early stages on the fetus or the baby that's growing inside them?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely understandable that during pregnancy women have lots of questions and worries about things that they put in their body. You know, this is, we almost sort of build women up to really think a lot about this. It's understandable that people would have questions, and to help people make a decision, you know, they need to have confidence in the information and evidence that's being presented to them. They need that to be consistent. They need to be able to talk to their health professionals. And I just don't think that that has been supported very well in this whole sort of minefield of online confusion and anti-vax messages.
Do you think the government have overlooked it too? Because we have the Chief Scientific Officer, Patrick Vallance, the Chief Medical Officer, Professor Whitty. We've had the Vaccines Minister, all urging people to have vaccines. But I don't recall them singling out pregnant women.
No, so we were quite frustrated, particularly when restrictions started to ease, you know, early in the spring, summer of this year, that there was very little focus on the clinically vulnerable group. Whereas last year, waves one and two, there was quite a lot of focus on clinically vulnerable group, and it just seemed to drop out of the guidance and the messages that people were hearing. So I think as restrictions eased, we had a number of things going on. We had very little focus on pregnant women as a clinically vulnerable group. So they weren't hearing the messages around the risks to them of COVID-19. And at the same time, we think the vaccination programme was very slow to really prioritise and think about pregnant women as a specific group.
Are you calling on the government to do more, or Public Health England, or whatever health agency it should be?
Yeah, I mean, we really want the government and devolved administrations to have much more focus on pregnancy as a clinically vulnerable group. There's a lot of talk about learning lessons. I gave evidence to a petitions committee earlier in the summer, which really focused in on this group and the lessons that needed to be learned, how they hadn't been prioritised, hadn't had the clear information and support that they needed. But time and time again, at every phase of the pandemic, we see the group being overlooked again. I think it's really important that there are focused, targeted information campaigns for this group that really helps them get the clear and consistent, trusted information that they need to make decisions and look after themselves.
Finally on that, Sarah, there will be pregnant women listening to this, or there'll be mothers and fathers of pregnant daughters listening to this who haven't been jabbed. What's your simple message to them?
My simple message is to please go to the website of the Royal College of Midwives or the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecology. You can find links to their information on the NCT website. Please make sure that it's that information that you're looking at, because it is evidence-based. And then go and talk to a health professional. They'll be able to talk through any questions and worries that you have.
All right, that's Sarah McMullen. She's Director of Impact and Engagement at the childbirth charity NCT, with some very powerful and important advice. Thanks for joining us. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood is here with the latest. So, Bruce Klingsohn, now that is a football manager, Newcastle. Am I right?
Yeah, so Steve Bruce, all the talk since the Saudi Arabians took charge of Newcastle when they bought it last week has been that Steve Bruce, who's deeply unpopular amongst the Newcastle fans, the first thing they would do to get the fans on side with this takeover would be to sack Steve Bruce, and that would win a few brownie points. However, they have announced that Steve Bruce will be in charge of the game, their first game in charge, the first game under the new ownership, which is on Sunday against Tottenham, and Steve Bruce will be there. Now, it's pretty unfortunate for Bruce. He's pretty much dead man walking. But they haven't got their house in order yet in order to sack him and to either appoint someone else or to put his assistant in charge. So Steve Bruce will be there, and he might as well have a sort of gangplank on the side of the pitch as much as anything, because, you know, he knows his number's up. It's just a matter of when. But we all thought it would happen before this game, so that the fans could turn up on Sunday and really celebrate, which they obviously are celebrating, this new takeover, whether we like it or not, and without the manager that they so despise in the dugout. But they're going to have to suck it up, the fact that that manager will still be there on Sunday. And actually, interestingly, it will be his 1,000th game as a manager. So maybe the Saudi Arabians thought, well, we can't sack him on 999. That would be unfair.
I've never thought of Saudis as sentimental, Matt.
Yes, you're probably right.
Now, will Ben Stokes play in the Ashes? We hope so, because otherwise we're going to get whacked, aren't we?
We are. Well, yeah, we could even get whacked with Ben Stokes there. But yeah, this is intriguing, because we know that Ben Stokes has taken some time out because he's had personal issues, and also he's had this finger injury. The England management have been at pains to say, we are not rushing Ben back. Ben can come back when he's ready. And they've announced an Ashes squad without Ben Stokes in it. Now, that would all be fine, but Ben Stokes, for the second time now, has put something out on his social media channels showing him batting, showing him gripping a bat and batting in the net, which just seems slightly strange. You know, if he's not playing in the Ashes, why would he be doing this? And if he does want to play in the Ashes, why doesn't he just go to the England hierarchy and say, look, you know, I'm feeling good, I'm feeling like I could be available? So it's just all adds to the intrigue, and it just gets the those people sort of thinking, well, could he really, you know, is he possibly going to play? So there's hope there, and Ben Stokes is doing nothing to dampen those hopes.
Very good. And finally, sterling warning. I don't imagine that's about the fate of the pound on the international markets. I imagine this is Raheem Sterling.
You'd be absolutely right there, yeah. The fate of the pound would be beyond me. So, this is Raheem Sterling. Who, very interesting words from him in an interview, has basically said to Pep Guardiola, his manager at Man City, if you don't play me, I'm going to leave. So he has got a year and a half left on his current contract. He hasn't been first choice this season, and nor was he, to be fair, at the back end of last season. And he's saying in an interview with Financial Times, now he's not, to be fair to Raheem, he is not throwing his toys out of the pram. He's not, you know, sulking or anything. He's just saying, as a footballer, I want to play football. I want to be regular footballer. And if that's not happening at Man City, then obviously I'll look elsewhere. So, you know, perfectly reasonable, but it does put Pep Guardiola in an interesting position, because if he continues to not play him, he obviously won't sign a new deal. So a decision to be made for Pep this weekend.
And Manchester City have got so many big players in the squad. I suppose it's extraordinary they could lose a player of Sterling stature. How much would he go for, do you think, Matt?
Well, he would probably run his contract down, which has got a year and a half left, which means he'd leave on a free transfer.
Right.
Which means that he could command bigger wages at whatever club it is he chooses to go to. So, or alternatively, City might try to sell him in the coming summer, next summer, when he'd still have a year left on his deal, to try to make sure that they recoup a bit of money for him. And at that point, they could probably try and charge 50, 60 million. But of course, he would know he's got the power to sit it out for another year and and move on a free.
Who'd have thought footballers would be giving interviews to the Financial Times? 25 years ago, they never would, but they're paid so much money now. I imagine the FT wants to know all about their investment decisions, a little more than what they do on the pitch.
Well, yes, of course. You know, these people are of interest across the board, as you know.
Yeah, especially to me, Matt. That's the Deputy Sports Editor, Matt Gatwood. At last, ministers have confirmed they're going to scrap the costly PCR travel tests, which can cost more than £100. They'll be replaced with cheaper rapid lateral flow swabs from October the 24th. The move could save a family of four around £200 on a trip abroad and will improve confidence in the embattled travel sector. Or will it? I'm joined now by Ryan Howsam, who's founder and chairman of UK travel insurer Stayshore. Mr. Howsam, how important is this, do you think, to getting people back up in the air?
I think it's very important, actually, Andrew, for the travel industry. It's things are actually getting back to some level of normality. I know that in our area, we're above 2019, but I think that's more because of propensity to need travel insurance. But the general travel data is still down on sort of 2019. So I think it's incredibly important. But I think that coupled with a reduction in the red list countries is obviously going to help the travel sector get back to some level of normality.
And will the rule on the PCR test just count for the return flight back to Britain, or is it for outgoing tests as well?
No, it will just be for the back to Britain, because the outgoing tests will depend upon the inbound country and what their rules are.
I see. Now, we know that the Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, got into a spat with the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, because he wanted people to be supervised taking the rapid tests, so some form of Zoom camera looking at them. But now it's been ruled that a photograph of the negative result on a mobile phone will be sufficient.
Well, I'm not sure if that's the case. My understanding of it was that then there's going to be some tech in place where you're going to have to load this up to some type of central database, and the list of companies that are going to operate this is going to be available from the 22nd of October, just in time for the half term from the 24th, which is good. But obviously, there's going to be a huge demand for this. So, who are the companies? What are the costs? And what's the process? Not all of that is still up in the air.
Because one of the whole points of this is to make it much less onerous and to cost much less money.
Yes.
But these companies, if they're commercial, and they will be commercial, they're going to make a charge, of course. But you've had no guidance yet. How much?
No, and that's the problem, and it's typical of what we've seen from the government all along, that they'll announce these things, and it's good, but if I was doing this, I'd be trying to announce this is what it's going to cost, this is who the companies are, this is the process, but it's all last minute, so we're still a little bit in the dark as to what the costs are and how you're going to go about doing it. And I don't think it's not going to be the lateral flow that you've got from the NHS that's free. That would obviously be really great if they could just utilize that and we could then just put it on our phone and off we go. But obviously there's still a commercial angle in this for companies that are going to be involved in the testing.
And can you tell me, Mr. Howsam, have you seen numbers sharply increasing now, people taking out holiday travel insurance, especially going abroad?
Yeah, we've seen a big increase. And I think it's really quite interesting that the travelling numbers are still below, as I said earlier, the 2019 numbers, but the people taking travel insurance numbers are up. So that just goes to show that consumers really do feel that travel insurance is an absolute necessity in the environment we currently find ourselves in.
And just finally, are they asking in that travel insurance whether they're covered against COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a prerequisite. So the fact that we led the market during this period, as I think we've talked about before, has sort of set us in good stead. I mean, it's imperative that if you're getting travel insurance that you've got COVID cover as part of any insurance that you've got.
Advice, Ryan Howsam there, founder and chairman of UK travel insurer Stayshore. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to this show all over again. It's the Andrew Pearce Show. I'm not around next week, but I'll be back the week after next.